Let's read from the book of Esther. It's on page, around about page 501. Book of Esther, chapter 1. With that background in mind, let's read. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces, stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the capital of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials, the military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When those days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the 7 eunuchs who served him, Memuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the peoples and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king, Karshina, Shethat, Admathar, Tarshish, Meres, Marsina, and Memucan, the 7 nobles of Persia and Media who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. According to law, what must be done to Queen Vashti, he asked. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuch taken to her. Then Memucan replied in the presence of the king and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end to the disrespect and discord. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. And let the king give her a royal position to someone else who is better than she. Then, when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. The king and his nobles were pleased with this advice, so the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, and to each people in its own language, proclaiming in each people's tongue that every man should be ruler over his own household. Later, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done, and what he had decreed about her. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, "Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful girls into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of all the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the girl who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin, named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiachin, king of Judah. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. The girl, who was also known as Esther, was lovely in form and features, and Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many girls were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Haggai. Esther also was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Haggai, who had charge of the harem. The girl pleased him and won his favor. Immediately he provided her with beauty treatments and special food. He assigned to her 7 maids selected from the king's palace and moved her and her maids into the best place in the harem. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked to and fro near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. Before a girl's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. And this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go there, and in the morning, return to another part of the harem to the care of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. When the turn came for Esther, the girl Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle, Abihail, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his nobles and officials. He proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality.
Well, do keep those chapters of Esther. We're going to try and attempt to do 4 chapters of Esther in the next hour and a half. And I hope it won't feel like that. But do you ever wonder whether the God you read in the Bible is the same God you experience in your day-to-day existence? So in the Bible we read of God's power, we read of his involvement with creation, and we look around and question, where is God now? I mean, in one sense, we want him to act like he does in the books of Exodus or the books of Kings in the days of David. But instead, there's seeming silence, a seeming lack of involvement. Is God at work? And as we read Esther, the same question arises because, as you probably know, not once is God mentioned in this book. And yet, as we will see, he is far from not at work. And I think the book of Esther is here in part to help us with this question of God's seeming silence. See, for it seems to me that God acts today more like he does in the book of Esther than, say, the days of Exodus. See, for as we read the book of Esther, we'll see that there are no great miracles, that there's no great demonstrations of God's power, and yet it becomes clear God is very much at work, just in a different way to the days of Exodus. And so Esther becomes a great encouragement to us in helping us understand how God is at work today in a time of no great miracles or mighty demonstrations of his power. And what we see in the first 4 chapters of Esther is we're introduced to the characters and the plot, and we don't discover spiritual heroes like Joseph or Daniel, but instead, flawed, weak, foolish people. So firstly then, a weak king. So we've seen by the video, the year is now 483 BC, so we're 40 years on from when we were looking at the book of Haggai. The king is now Xerxes, who is the son of Darius, The king who had allowed Haggai and that rebuilding the temple, as it were, to start. But sadly, from all accounts, both biblical and secular, Xerxes is not anywhere near the kind of king his father was. Darius would have been thought of much like we think of our queen. Xerxes is closer to Prince Harry. I mean, Xerxes seems to be the kind of king who would have had his picture taken playing naked billiards in Vegas, whatever that is. And we see that in the first few verses. See verse 3. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the province were present. Anyone who is anyone is there. And verse 4, for a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. For 6 months, Xerxes partied. And then, at the end of that party, verse 5, he gives another banquet that lasts 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa, the capital city. And it was a lavish party. Expensive purple linen cloths were on the wall. Couches not from Next or even M&S, but from Harrod. Gold and silver couches were present. Pavements were decorated with costly stones. Wine was served in gold goblets abundantly, each man having what they wished, verse 8. For all intents purposes, Xerxes looked an impressive, wealthy, powerful king. I mean, he ruled 127 provinces, all the way from India to Kush, Ethiopia. He throws lavish parties that everyone wants to be at. You wouldn't have said, oh, I'm painting my toenails this evening, Xerxes, or I've got to have my hair washed. No, you'd want to be at this party. And yet what we read next reveals that this king was in fact weak and with little substance. See verse 10. The party's in full flow. The king's drunk on wine. And he commands his weak queen's presence. And he commands his queen's presence so that he may display her as part of his wealth. Kind of just like getting another trophy out of the trophy cabinet. Look at my trophy. Look at my beautiful wife. And the queen refuses to come. And she refuses doing so, knowing it would have severe consequences for her. And when the king hears, he becomes furious and he burns with anger, verse 12. So he seeks his wise men and he demands to know what can be done about the queen's disobedience, verse 15. And the wise men's response is not exactly wise. In fact, you could say it was like trying to fight a mosquito by launching heat-seeking missiles. The words overkill and overreaction come to mind. See, they declare, verse 16, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There'll be no end of disrespect and discord. I mean, it's a little over the top. It's a little domestic squabble, not a declaration of war against the whole nation. I mean, what you want the wise men to say to King Xerxes is, Xerxes, man up and go and speak with your wife. Find out what's wrong. Stop treating her like a trophy. But no, they have a better solution. And they manipulate the king. And they say, verse 19, Vashti is never again to enter the presence of the king, and let's replace her with someone better. With the better meaning, someone who will obey and who is prettier. Then let's announce the king's edict to all his vast realm so that all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. And it's a laughable solution to a domestic squabble when you end up commandeering respect for wives through threats. And the utter irony and the foolishness of it all is that the very thing they fear in verse 17, all women knowing, is the very result they achieve as the edict is sent to all people in every tongue. Now everyone definitely knows. See, Xerxes may be able to throw a good party. He may look impressive, but in truth he's a weak king, with a wife who does not respect him, with civil servants who manipulate him, and actions that are downright foolish. And I think we're meant to read this, and particularly the Jews were meant to read this and think how foolish we are. How foolish we are. See, here are the Jews who are now under this weak, foolish king because ultimately they rejected the true king all those years before. That's why they're in exile. That's why they're under the Median and Persian king. Because all those years before, when things begin to seem to get bad, they thought the other kings could save them. They were impressed by the splendor and the wealth and the seeming power of these mighty nations, who in reality turned out to have little substance and little love for them. That's why they're in exile. They'd rejected the true king, and they turned to these weak and ultimately foolish kings. And I think we're meant to read this and feel that pain. And yet how often we do the same, don't we? We reject the true king as we're attracted and dazzled and wowed by the seeming wealth and power and prestige and honor that the rulers of this world offer. And we think that somehow life under the true king, King Jesus, is dull and boring and harsh, whilst life under the rulers of this world is exuberant and full and fun. And we forget that the true king, King Jesus, promised that life with him was to the full. That the true king promises the greatest banquet, the greatest feast ever. Think of those words in Revelation 19, that great wedding supper of the Lamb that we are invited to as those who belong to the true king. It's a banquet that far surpasses that of King Xerxes in chapter 1. And it's in surroundings far more lavish than that described in chapter 1. I mean, think of Revelation 21, 22. And you read of the splendor of Jesus' kingdom, where the pavements are not just lined with some costly stone, but every costly stone. And the walls are not lined with white and purple linen, they're made of gold. And how often, like the Jews before us, we turn our backs on the best in order to gain what we think is better now, which turns out to be nothing at all. How foolish we are. And yet still God is gracious. And through this one weak king's action, he'll bring about a magnificent salvation. A weak king. Secondly, a compromised queen, chapter 2. A compromised queen. See, the problem left at the end of chapter 1 was that the king now doesn't have a queen. And they need to find someone better. And so chapter 2 begins with when the king's anger has subsided and the question's now raised, who would replace Vashti? And the king's attendants propose, verse 2, that a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Then they say, then let the girl who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. And I just love the next bit at the end of verse 4. the advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. Of course it appealed to the king. He's the partying king, and his royal advisor just proposed to gather all the beautiful virgins in his vast empire to hold an X-rated beauty contest, and he's the only judge. Of course Xerxes is smiling. And then we read verse 7, we're introduced to one of the candidates, Esther. And now remember what the officials are looking for. They're not looking for someone with the ability to speak eloquently on global affairs. They're not looking for a Margaret Thatcher. They simply have to be beautiful young virgins. And how is Esther described? Verse 7. Well, not only was she beautiful to look at from a distance, she was also beautiful when seated across the dinner table, much like my wife. It's true. Just thought I'd get it in there. Esther, we're told, was lovely in form and features. The only problem is that this beautiful young woman, Esther, is an exiled Jew. We're told that in verses 5 to 7 as we learn about her cousin Mordecai's descendants. And we see that he's from the tribe of Benjamin, and he was exiled from Jerusalem, and now he's caring for Esther because her parents have died and she's his cousin, but he's taken her on as his daughter. And so we have a Jew and is entering a beauty contest to be the queen. And remember, God's people have been commanded to be distinctive from the nations around them. They were not to intermarry. And they were certainly not allowed to participate in X-rated beauty contests. So what would happen when the king's officials come knocking at the door? Would Esther hide under her own bed or enthusiastically sign up for the chance of sleeping in another bed? Well, verse 8. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many girls were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Haggai. Esther also was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Haggai, who had charge of the harem. We're not told if there was any choice given to the candidates in the contest, although it does seem very unlikely that these young girls were asked politely if they would like to accompany the royal officials back to the citadel of Susa. However, before we conveniently conclude that Esther was simply a powerless pawn being manipulated by a superior force, let's pay attention to what we're told in verse 9. The girl pleased him, Haggai, and won his favor. Immediately he provided her with beauty treatments and special food. He assigned to her 7 maids, selected from the king's palace, and moved her and her maids into the best place in the harem. Instead of playing hard to get, Esther was doing her best to get ahead. She wanted to win. And to ensure she did, she tried to win the favor of the chief pimp. I mean, it's not a very Daniel-like example, is it? And once she's won his favor, she's given special privileges, beauty treatments and servants and special food and keys to the best accommodation in the harem. Was Esther a spiritual saint? Well, things are not looking good for her. I mean, we've already seen it's possible to refuse the demands of an empire if you're prepared to suffer the consequences. Do you remember Queen Vashti? She defied the wishes of a king. However, from what we've read so far of Esther, Esther seems to be a very different woman. She had even more reason to defy the Persian government. She was one of God's people. She was a Jew in a foreign land. But instead of standing out from the crowd, she was rather keen to get into bed with the king. And she was breaking Jewish laws and Sabbath requirements to do so. And look what we're told in verse 10. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background, because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. She was hiding her identity. And it seems that Mordecai, who should have been protecting her, was also keen for her to get ahead. And in case you're thinking, well, she's just obeying her father figure, There is nothing to indicate she protested. Think of the readings of Joseph or Daniel, where we're told about how they make a stand. Esther did not do that. Now, we don't know what would have happened if she'd have spoken up and said she was a Jew. Perhaps she would have been disqualified from the contest. Perhaps everything would have continued as normal. But that's not the point. We're not supposed to make decisions based on a future we cannot predict and cannot control. We're supposed to trust God for the outcome and make the right choices in the present. Esther was not a spiritual hero. At this point in her life, she's a spiritual rebel. And what did each competitor have to do to win this beauty contest? Well, verses 12 to 14 tell us the answer. They prepared themselves for 12 months for one night with the king. Imagine that, guys. You're standing at the front door. You say, "Darling, we've got 5 minutes to get out." And she shouts down, "I need 12 months. And what's even more worrying is these were the beautiful ones that took 12 months. Now, the Bible doesn't explicitly tell us what happened during each girl's night with the king. But given that we're told very explicitly that in the morning they were not allowed to return to be with the virgins, but took their place with the concubines, I don't think it's that difficult to work out what took place a few hours earlier. See, what did each girl have to do in order to win this competition? Quite simply, the winner was the girl who provided King Xerxes with the greatest sexual pleasure in bed. That was the contest Esther was trying to win and did. Verse 17. The king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. In other words, she was the best in bed. And so he made her queen. And does what he does best. He holds a party. A lowly Jewish girl who compromised her faith is now queen of Persia. And it's easy to look down on her. But how quick are we at times to compromise, to hide our identity, to get ahead? To get ahead at work, to get ahead at school, to become popular, to do that which we know does not please the Lord Jesus, but we do it because we want to fit in, to get ahead, to win, to be successful. See, Esther was not called to deny her faith. She just hid it. She privatized it. Is it really such a big deal if no one outside this church building even knows we come here regularly and indeed profess to be a believer of the Lord Jesus? Is it a big deal if we conceal our faith at school, at work, to get ahead, to earn a friendship, to be accepted by our peers? Is it a big deal? Yes. Jesus says, if anyone is ashamed of me and my word in this sinful and adulterous generation, then I will be ashamed of him when I come in my Father's glory with the holy angels. See, as we read chapter 2, we're meant to see the dangers of compromise. We're meant to hear the challenge not to assimilate to the world around us and live like everyone else. How are you compromising? A weak king, a compromised queen, a provoked uncle and a vindictive enemy, chapter 3, right to the end of verse 4, chapter 4 even. So you haven't been introduced to the king and the queen, we're now introduced to the main plot, and it centres around a conflict between Mordecai and Haman. And Mordecai has just proven his loyalty to the king in the verses before, at the end of chapter 2, by foiling an assassination attempt on the king. However, for some reason, Mordecai is not rewarded. We're not told why at this point, but what we are told is that it's recorded for us in the annals of Persia, which is important, as we'll see in a couple of weeks' time. But for now, there's no reward. But instead we learn, chapter 3, verse 1, that after these events, a man called Haman is elevated to a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. And all the royal officials, verse 2, knelt apart from one, Mordecai. And Mordecai refuses, not because Jews are not permitted to bow to civil servants, they were, in much the same way we would bow to the queen. He refuses because of a family rivalry. See, the writer of Esther tells us clearly what family these men came from. Remember back chapter 2, verse 5? Mordecai is from the tribe of Benjamin. Haman, we're told, chapter 3, verse 1, is an Agagite, a descender of King Agar, who was the king of the Amalekites. These people, the Amalekites, were the constant enemy of the Jews. We first meet them in Exodus chapter 17 as they fight the Israelites. And God promises to destroy the Amalekites in Deuteronomy 25. And so the Jews and the Amalekites hated each other, but for a Benjamite like Mordecai, would have felt it even more. Because King Agar, descendant of Haman, fought King Saul, a Benjamite. Now Hagar lost to Saul, 1 Samuel 15, but still the feud existed between the Agagites and the Benjamites. They hated each other. And so for Mordecai to bow down, it would have been like a German Jew in 1940 bowing to Hitler. Now what provoked Mordecai, who'd previously kept his faith, to suddenly be concerned about such matters and to take a stand at this point, the Bible does not say. But we do learn it was his Jewishness that prompted his action, verse 4. And whatever it was that pricked his conscience, and it's fair to assume, I think, it was God, it caused him to take a stand that would bring about severe consequences. And it's worth just pausing there, isn't it? You see, it's never too late to take a stand for God, even if there are consequences. Mordecai spent years hiding his Jewishness. And now suddenly at this point, on this issue, he takes a stand. It's a hero moment for him. And he takes it. Maybe that's you. For years, no one at school or at work knows you're a Christian. Maybe they just know you as a churchgoer, as a kind of religious person, but they don't know what you really believe. You've never taken a stand on a particular issue that is going around the office or at school. One which you knew you should have taken a stand on. Maybe at school it was the bullying of someone else in the class and you just allowed it to go on. You never took a stand. Maybe at school it was the slight misdiscretions of the wrongful use of expenses and you never said a thing. But maybe tomorrow the time has come for you to take a stand. Maybe tomorrow is your hero moment when, like Mordecai, you stand firm and act as one who is a believer in Christ, even if it has severe consequences. See, as Mordecai stood, Haman's hatred rose. And having learned Mordecai is a Jew, Haman looks for a way not just to destroy Mordecai, but also his people, the Jews, God's people. In every generation, there are those who will vindictively hate God's people. Haman was that man for this generation. And so Haman casts lots to discover what day would be best to execute his plan, and the lot falls on the 12th month, verse 7, 11 months' time. Plenty of time for a rescue operation. And with the date set, Haman now sets off to gain the king's permission. And the king, who, as we've seen, is weak and foolish, is easily manipulated and bought. And so, verse 10, the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. So on the 13th day of the first month, the edict is issued with the order, verse 13, to kill and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and little children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar. And the edict is issued to every corner of the vast empire, every 127th province. Here's this edict. But what you need to know is this. The 13th day of the first month, the day the edict is issued, is the eve of Passover. And for those Jews, as they hear that edict issued, the question surely is being raised in their mind as they sit down to celebrate the Passover and remember God's great rescue of his people from Egypt. What will God do now? What will God do now as his people are once again faced with being wiped out? Will God save in an Exodus-like manner, or will it be in some other means? And as the question is raised, what we see, verse 15, is the king and Haman enjoying a drink while everyone else is in turmoil, not least Mordecai. And Mordecai, having been provoked to take a stand, he's now provoked to mourn and fast with the other Jews seeking the Lord's intervention. And Esther hears of Mordecai's distress and sees his clothes, the sackcloth and the ash, and without finding out why, she sends clothes to him. You kind of get the impression that she was slightly embarrassed of her father's dress sense. Some things just don't change, do they? But Mordecai refuses the change of clothes, and now Esther wants to know why he's so distressed. And Mordecai is keen, she knows. So verse 7, he tells her everything. He gives her a copy of the edict, and he requests her help, encouraging her, verse 8, to go into the king's presence, to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. And Esther's response is not exactly that of a spiritual hero. See verse 11, all the kings, she says, of all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court, without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. And the only exception to this is for the king to extend the golden scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. Uncle Mordecai, Daddy, can you not see the danger I'm in if you ask me to go in and see the king? I haven't seen him for 30 days and marriage isn't so good. Please don't ask me to do this. Her first instinct is to kind of save yourself. Not her people, it's I'm an all right Jack kind of attitude. But Mordecai is quick to point out to her, verse 12, do not think that because you're in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this. Now whether Mordecai's words are threats, or just a matter of fact, Esther's attitude changes as she calls for her fellow Jews to pray and fast, as she promises to go to the king. And as the plot thickens, the less than savoury figures begin to come good. But the question on all our lips is still, what will God do? After all, he's promised a Messiah will come through these people, not just a Messiah for them, but a Messiah for the world, one who will rescue and save this world. Surely he cannot allow these Jews to die, to be annihilated. What will he do? And fourthly then, very briefly, we see the providential God. See, the answer to what will God do is seen in verse 14, chapter 4. And who knows, but you have come to a royal position for such a time as this. See, you could read the book of Esther and think, well, where is God? Or you could begin like Mordecai, who's beginning to see things spiritually and just wonder whether God has allowed all these events for a purpose. You see, did it really just happen that the king got drunk and foolishly asked for his wife? Did it really just happen to be that day that Vashti would refuse, leading to a vacancy? Did it just so happen to be that Esther was Jewish and beautiful? Did it just so happen to be that Esther is favoured over every other virgin? Did it just so happen to be that Mordecai would foil an assassination attempt, meaning that his name was written in the book of the annals, as we would see later? Did it just so happen that Haman would be promoted, setting up a conflict? Did it just so happen that Mordecai at that point would decide to take a stand against a family feud that was been going for generations? Did it just so happen that the lots fell on the 11th month from that day? Did it just so happen that the day the edict was issued was on the eve of the Passover? Did it just so happen that a Jewish girl called Esther was queen at exactly this point in the history of Mede and Persia? Did all these things just happen? No. For the believer, you have to say these things were not just random coincidences, but the workings of a sovereign God. But that's the thing with providence. Providence is God's protective care of us, his working out of his purposes in our life. We often only see providence and his care with hindsight, as you look back at how God has been at work to protect and to care and to bring you to this situation. And it's right for us as believers that as we're faced with a situation to see if we can see God's providential hand leading us and guiding us to a particular point. We might not always see it, and we must do it tentatively, but we believe in a sovereign God who is at work, not just in an Exodus way, but in a behind-the-scenes Esther way too. And so when we're faced with a particular situation, it's right to say, have I been brought to this for such a time? Now, let's be clear. God has allowed the situation in Esther to arise, and he will, as we'll see in a couple of weeks' time, use it for his good and his purposes. But that is not to say that Esther and Mordecai's actions were right and good. In his grace, God knew our foolishness and disobedience. That does not mean that we were right. It means he was gracious. It means he is sovereign. And we know Romans 8:28 that in all things, even through a compromised queen, a weak king, a foolish uncle, God works for the good of those who love him, his people. And we see that most evidently at the cross, that God uses the actions of wicked men to bring about the greatest good, as we'll celebrate shortly around the communion table. Is our God at work? Absolutely. Is our God at work even when he seems silent? Absolutely. Is our God at work even when we cannot see it and there are no great demonstrations of his power or miraculous works? Absolutely. Do you see how awesome our God is? What will you do about it?